park than a garden, staging separate but unified California ideas with direct native sun humor. Land use, for example, is a long, narrow chunk of concrete-colored granite atop a landscape knoll. A meandering stream flows from the mountainous water source past desert land and onto squat, stylized water use. My own favorite is Spirit of the Lima Bean.
Sweet beans, lima beans. My mouth eats water for the lima bean.
15 desert-colored decomposed granite boulders piled up in honor of South Coast Plaza's primary developers. You guessed it, the Segerstrom family. We do need to point out where this large art center is. Smack dab in the middle of the South Coast Plaza Mega Mall, a development which, in its own way, pays homage to the idea of Orange County as theme park. Home to Disneyland, of course, the world's first theme park, Knott's Berry Farm, and one of the best political theme parks anywhere, the Nixon Presidential Library. South Coast Plaza is essentially a theme park for consumerism, celebrating both the culture of consumerism and consumerism as culture. Consumerism as culture. We've finally arrived at the heart of this place, at a time when, politically, we still avoid the question at the heart of our age. Can we give this up, this belief that we have to have more, and that more always means better? Can we give up consuming the world to save our world, to save ourselves from ourselves? Well, we'll just have to see. Until next time, this is Kim Weir for Up the Road.
Thank you, Kim Lear, Up the Roads. This is KZFR, FM 90.1, Chico, community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you're listening to Ecotopia, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, technological. Tonight, our ecosystem is reindeer and their environment. And shortly, we'll bring you an interview live from the North Pole with Susie the Reindeer. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Lily's Brazilian Bistro, offering traditional Brazilian cuisine made from fresh, locally sourced organic ingredients. She's in the heart of downtown Chico. Lily's Brazilian Bistro serves traditional Brazilian dishes as diverse, exciting, and colorful as Brazil itself. Located at 142 Broadway, they're open Monday through Saturday from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. with dine-in and outdoor seating. More information, including to-go orders and reservations, at 530-3999-0675 and on Facebook and Instagram. And we're made possible by Chico Performances, presenting jazz at Lincoln Center, performing Songs We Love, a musical journey through the history of jazz, music from the 20s through the 50s. The world-renowned performers of the jazz at Lincoln Center take the stage with three vocalists to celebrate the songs of the early jazz era, made famous by Frank Sinatra, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Judy Garland, and others. The concert is on January 24th in Laxon Auditorium. More information at chicoperformances.com. We're back with our interview with Susie the Reindeer after this.
Dasher and Dancer and Prancer and Vixen, Comet and Cupid and Donner and Blitzen. But do you recall the most famous reindeer of all? Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer had a very shiny nose, and if you ever saw it, you would even say it glows. All of the other reindeer used to laugh and call him names. They never let poor Rudolph join in any reindeer games. Then one foggy Christmas Eve, Santa came to say, Rudolph, with your nose so bright, won't you guide my sleigh tonight? Then how the reindeer loved him as they shouted out with glee, Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer, you'll go down in history. Even say it glows. All of the other reindeer used to laugh and call him names. They never let poor Rudolph join in any reindeer games. Then one foggy Christmas Eve, Santa came to say, Rudolph, with your nose so bright, won't you guide my sleigh tonight? Then how the reindeer loved him as they shouted out with glee, Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer, you'll go down in history.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and tonight our ecosystem is in the Arctic, including the tundra and the creatures that live there. One of those creatures, of course, is the reindeer, and we're working on making connections right now with the North Pole and Santa's compound. Okay, I think we're through. On the line with us is Susie the reindeer, one of the sled pullers, and I'm told she is also called the 10th reindeer. Welcome, Susie.
I am happy to be on your show.
First off, Susie, I want to ask you to explain, why are you called the 10th reindeer?
Well, you know all about the original eight, Dasher and Dancer and all those. And then Rudolph was added to the line. Rudolph gets a lot of publicity. He's on TV. He's on T-shirts. You see him all the time. Toys made with red noses. And he was widely applauded for guiding the sleigh with his nose so bright. But reindeer pull in pairs, and I am linked up with Rudolph as the 10th reindeer.
I see. That makes good sense. Well, I can understand that you might be a little envious of Rudolph.
No, not envious. But I do think that your listeners should know a little more about sleigh pulling than what they see in cartoons, where I am, by the way, left out. And it wouldn't hurt for them to learn more about us as their fellow creatures on this planet.
Understood. And we do recognize and celebrate you as fellows and gal animals on the planet.
Well, to begin, I want to correct a widespread misunderstanding. We are actually caribou, but you call us reindeer. We go by that name, too. The use of the terms reindeer and caribou for essentially the same animal can cause confusion. The International Union for Conservation of Nature clearly delineates the issue. Reindeer is the European name for the species of Rangifer, while in the North America, Rangifer species are known as caribou.
Oh, Susie, You got to get that.
I'm cold.
Cough under
I've
control.
Got a. I got a cold, and I have to get over it before a week from weekend.
Not that much time. Yeah.
No. So, in case you're interested, the word caribou often comes through French from the first Canadian language, Mi'kmaq. The word meaning snow shoveler, and refers to our habit of pawing through the snow for food.
Oh, thank you for that lesson in etymology and foraging. I imagine the snow is pretty deep up there at the North Pole, and how cold is it?
Oh, it's pretty cold up here. Right now, it's 31 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. The snow is not that deep compared to some of your mountains in the High Sierra. Ours is 40 inches in depth, but remember, that is on top of 3 feet of Arctic ice. There is no ground or dirt under the pole. And right now, December 20th, we get a little more than 3 hours of daylight.
So, Susie, tell us a little more about the northern caribou.
Sure, but first I need to point out that the caribou here in Santa Land are the only ones actually at the North Pole. Most North American caribou live farther south in Canada and Alaska. And I got here because I learned about a job opening in Santa Land and applied online. I got moving expenses and a reasonable salary with benefits. I save a lot because there's no place to spend it here at the North Pole.
In that case, how many caribou are there elsewhere in the world?
There are probably, it's kind of sad, really. It's about 950,000 living all around the world, including Finland, Norway, and Greenland. But most of us are in the North American Arctic. And although we are one species, there are 7 subspecies around the world. In the Arctic, we are rather unceremoniously called the barren ground caribou, and we mostly live in the tundra. There's a small herd of what are called woodland caribou, but they don't fit into the Christmas sleigh tradition.
Tell me a little bit about your physical size, your height, and if you're willing to share it, your weight.
Sure, I'm not vain. I'm pretty big, I'll tell you. Last time I checked, I weighed in at a trim 250 pounds. I'm in good shape for the sleigh run. The boy caribou average around 350 to 400 pounds. For height, I'm about 6 feet tall. And the boys are a little taller, not counting antlers. Did you know that both male and female caribou have antlers? Although Mr. Rudolph's are much larger than mine. Size is no measure of performance.
Oh, ha-ha, indeed. Susie, I read, too, that you caribou might be related to giraffes.
Well, we don't have long necks, but we do belong to a large group of hoofed ungulate mammals in the order Artiodactyls, which also includes pigs, can you believe that, hippos, camels, giraffes, antelopes, llamas, and many other terrestrial, even toed hoofed animals. Some definitions also include certain cetaceous marine animals in this group, namely whales.
That's an impressive set of relations.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go on to diet. What do caribou eat?
Well, as you might guess, we are vegetarians. In fact, we eat organic, except in those places where humans have polluted the ground. In the winter, we eat mostly lichens that survive in the cold. In the so-called summer, which only lasts a couple of months, even with the sun shining 20 hours a day, we eat leaves of willow and birches, grasses and sedges. When residing on rich ground, I might eat 5 kilograms of food each day. And we caribou are migratory. We have to keep moving in order to find adequate food, and sometimes we travel very long distances at a time.
I'm interested to hear about where caribou babies come from and when.
Well, because of my work here at the Pole, I have chosen to remain celibate, which is frankly okay with me, but the mating season occurs in the autumn. And so, you know, if I were to have babies, I'd be pregnant when trying to haul that sleigh. So the mating season is in autumn and the calving season is during the springtime. More specifically, the males fight for access to females. It's not a pretty sight. In fact, the most dominant boy caribou are able to collect as many as 15 to 20 females in order to mate with all of them. And honestly, I'm not interested in that kind of scene.
I understand. Overall, though, it really seems to me that caribou, you're a Darwinian miracle. I mean, you've adapted to the harsh climate. You've evolved physical structures that help you survive. And despite the ruckus over mating, y'all have figured out survival of the fittest.
But that's not the whole story. This is the bad stuff. It seems, I mentioned human intervention, and it seems that after many, many, a million years on Earth, the caribou is under threat of global extinction. In Canada, several herds have all gone extinct. Let me explain. For caribou, survival in the harsh Arctic, where the ecosystem is fragile and plant growth slow, it requires almost constant movement. The food and the habitat resource of the Arctic ecosystem on which we depend are easily destroyed by human disturbance. Unfortunately, such disturbances are widespread and include, and this is the worst news, oil and gas exploration and the roads and infrastructure that go along with that. And then there's the impacts of changing climate, which is also caused by, I don't mean to be harsh here, but you humans. It's causing ice storms that glaze over the tundra vegetation, more frequent fires that kill the lichen, early peaking of the best spring forage before the herd arrives in the refuge to breed, and increases in mosquitoes significant enough to interfere with feeding.
Well, Susie, is there anything we humans can do to stop the loss of caribou?
Duh. Stop what you're doing. Save the earth. Look at all the fellow creatures around you and think of them, not just yourselves.
Point taken.
There are organizations in the U.S., Canada, and the Scandinavian countries that are fighting to preserve the caribou, mostly by protecting the land we travel over. For example, a pregnant female will not cross lands where oil drilling is taking place. But this is not working. Several local herds in Canada have recently gone extinct. I've told you about that. And the caribou protection people are working hard, but our future is not bright.
That is not only tragic, but heartbreaking. Aside from the fact that you are remarkable creatures, you, Susie, Dasher, Dancer, Comet, Cupid, Prancer, Vixen, Donner, and Blitzen, you and Rudolph bring happiness to children all over the world. We thank you for doing that, Susie the reindeer. Hope you get over your cold and your cough, and thank you for alerting us on Ecotopia to the dangers facing your species.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure to be with you, but I hope you tell all of your listeners, I'm telling them right now, you have to do more to save the earth. You have to do more to think about your fellow creatures. Thank you for letting me talk to your audience.
You're quite welcome. That was an informative and disturbing interview. We'll be taking a short break now. Then we'll be back to tell more about the Arctic tundra, including some ways we can do better at saving the caribou and the threats to that unique ecosystem. This is Ecotopia on KZFR.
You put your hooves out, you put your hooves in, and you shake them all about. You do the reindeer pokey and you turn yourself around. That's what it's all about. you put your antlers in, you put your antlers out, you put your antlers in, and you shake them all about. You do the reindeer pokey and you turn yourself around. That's what it's all about. You put your tail in, you put your tail out, you put your tail in, and you shake it all about. You do the reindeer pokey and you turn yourself around. That's what it's all about. You put your red nose in, you put your red nose out, you put your red nose in, and you shake it all about. You do the reindeer pokey and you turn yourself around. That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about.
That was the Kaboomers doing the reindeer pokey. You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. Tonight we're looking at the ecosystem of reindeer, or caribou, and their environment. I'm Stephen Chudy, and my co-host is Susan Chudy, who is not to be confused with Susie the reindeer.
As we explore the ecosystem of caribou and other plants and animals in the far north, we often hear of the tundra. Many of us think of it in general terms as a flat, cold, barren landscape in the Arctic, or in a football season, we hear from time to time of the frozen tundra of Lambeau Field in Green Bay, Wisconsin. But the tundra is far more complex than that. Here's a short audio from National Geographic that does an excellent job of laying out the basics. And yes, listeners, this will be on the final exam.
What are tundras? Tundras are among the Earth's coldest and harshest biomes. These ecosystems are treeless regions with extreme cold and low rainfall. There are two different types of tundras, alpine and Arctic. Alpine tundras occur on mountains where trees cannot grow in the high altitudes. There, the growing season is about 180 days. Mountain goats, sheep, marmots, and birds feed on low-lying plants and insects. Arctic tundra extends from the edge of the Arctic Ocean down to the coniferous forest of the taiga. Permafrost prevents trees from taking root. But shrubs and other vegetation grow during the short summers, which range from 50 to 60 days. A variety of wildlife, including Arctic foxes, polar bears, and caribou, live in the Arctic tundra. Global warming is changing the Arctic tundra, and the changing tundra is contributing to global warming. The Arctic's permafrost is deteriorating, which alters not only the landscape, but also the plants and animals that can live there. In addition, permafrost contains about 14% of the Earth's carbon. So as it melts, that carbon is released into the atmosphere, contributing to global warming.
Here's some additional information about the tundra. This comes from the Asia-Pacific Economic Group, which gives you a sense of the tundra's importance beyond the friendly confines of the Arctic.
The tundra biome is one of the coldest places on the planet. It's the coldest of all the biomes, and temperatures can easily reach minus 34 degrees centigrade. There's a summer growing season in this Arctic region, but summer only lasts for about 2 months, and temperatures can sometimes struggle to get above the freezing mark. Despite these weather challenges, life still finds a way to thrive up in the far north. Here are some interesting facts about this unique biome.
The animal population of the tundra fluctuates greatly over the course of a year. Some animals spend all year in the biome, choose to hibernate during the winter so they can be protected from the severe cold that can develop. Others will spend the warmer months in the Arctic and then go further south as the winds turn cold. It's definitely a difficult environment for life. The name tundra, in fact, comes from a Finnish word that means treeless land.
There are areas of the tundra biome that are inhabited. Parts of Russia, the United States, and Canada all have communities that are technically within the boundaries of the biome. Because of the harsh conditions, however, the vast majority of the tundra biome has yet to be explored because of the weather challenges that exist. New discoveries might be limited to this region if it ever is explored fully because of the weather, making it the last true undiscovered country on the planet today.
The tundra biome actually covers one-fifth of the total planet's surface. Despite this large space, only 48 animals are known to live there. There are only 400 flower varieties that grow within the biome as well. Part of the reason for this is because the soil is permanently frozen in this biome, so deep-rooted plants are unable to grow.
The tundra biome is actually called a sink. This is because the area is able to store massive amounts of carbon dioxide. The tundra biome actually stores more carbon dioxide than it releases every year. If the rest of the planet could replicate what this biome is able to accomplish, then global warming could become a forgotten memory of the past. That's not bad for a place that receives 24 hours of sunlight every day during the summer.
Interestingly, though we didn't list it earlier, Antarctica is included in the tundra biome, even though it's on the opposite pole of the planet. This is because the weather conditions at the South Pole are about as frigid in winter as they are at the North Pole.
Many think of hot, dry deserts of Earth as the driest biome, but the tundra biome has them all beat. There might be certain deserts that only receive 1 centimeter of rainfall every 5 years, but the entire tundra biome itself only receives 10 inches of rain every year. When compared with the entire precipitation cycle of the desert biome, the tundra wins every single time. This is because the warm temperatures barely begin to start the thawing process of the ground in summer, making it nearly impossible for enough moisture to develop and turn into weather.
The largest animal in the tundra biome, as you might guess, is the polar bear. It's one of the few living things on the tundra that doesn't like relying on composting stuff in order to survive. Polar bears like to have things like walrus and seal steaks for dinner because of all the stored fat that the animals have. Those fats help the polar bear have the energy reserves it needs in order to survive what is one of the longest winters on the planet. And that info came from the Asia-Pacific Economic Group.
We're particularly interested, though, in how the caribou survive. Discover Wildlife has this to say. Caribou can make use of antlers. While cattle horns have living tissue in the core, the antlers of reindeer are made of dead tissue that is impervious to the cold. Reindeer antlers are among the largest of any deer species. And unusually, they are present on both males and females. Eyes, to cope with the long dark winters of the Arctic, enhance their vision. Reindeer's eyes are very sensitive to ultraviolet light, a kind of night vision or night goggles built in.
And then there's the nose. As well as being furry, the nose has an internal heat exchange system. This means that each breath is warmed on its way to the lungs and cooled as it is exhaled so that water vapor is condensed before it can be puffed into the air. Also helping them out is the coat. There are two layers of fur consisting of an ultra-fine and a dense under fur and a shaggy outer layer. The outer hairs are hollow and provide insulation similar to the fur of a polar bear. And then there are the tendons. The tendons in the foot joint click as a reindeer walks. These sounds help herds stay together in low visibility, may even play a role in reinforcing social hierarchies. And finally, there are the feet. Large feet with two toes, two large dew claws. These spread to distribute the body weight and provide grip. And in snow, as we've said, reindeer use their hooves in a technique called cratering to dig through the snow and find food beneath. And the plants and animals that live beneath the snow. This is Ecotopia on KZFR.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and we're exploring the Arctic ecosystem of the tundra, where caribou and hardy plants and animals survive. But what about humans? The World Atlas reminds us the tundra is one of the Earth's coldest environments. There are no trees, and the soil is permanently frozen. The sun shines for 24 hours a day during the warmest days. Given all of these characteristics, it can be easy to see how it would be seem impossible for humans to live in the tundra.
Yet people do live in the tundra, and they have for as much as 20,000 years. The Arctic areas in North America are home to the Inuit people, the Innu, the Yupit, and the Yakut. Innovative uses of the environment have allowed people to survive here traditionally. Modern times are changing the face of life in the North. Traditionally, First Peoples used sleds made from the bones and skins of animals pulled by packs of dogs to navigate their way over the tundra. These sleds could pull people as well as their belongings over the ice and snow with ease when conditions were good and when the dogs were healthy. Inuit people also used kayaks for hunting on the water and Umiak larger boats for transporting people, supplies, and animals.
Traditional people living in the North survived for thousands of years on a diet of fish, seal, whale, walrus, and other Arctic animals. They also gathered small plants during the limited growing season. In Greenland, some people practice farming, but this is not usual in the North due to the very limited growing season. Hunters waiting for hours to catch their prey traditionally wore caribou skin or polar bear skin clothing, with the fur against their body and the skin facing out. Wearing two layers of caribou skin is said to keep you warm in just about any conditions.
Traditionally, people in the Arctic lived in igloos in the winter. These are, as you probably know, domed huts made of bricks of ice and snow. Many families lived together, and the community was important for companionship and survival. In summer, they would migrate to a summer camp, live in tents made of animal skins placed over a frame.
Of course, many of those traditional practices have disappeared as the tundra has become home to snowmobiles, convenience stores, and fossil-driven vehicles. We'll talk about the fossil fuel invasion and devastation in a bit, as well as efforts to preserve the tundra and the plants and animals that live there. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. Thank you. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and we're exploring the ecosystem of caribou, or reindeer, and their habitat. Several of the pieces we have read tonight refer to the various threats to the tundra. We had hoped to have a couple of live interviews at this point, so we'll turn to the web. One of the organizations looking out for the environment is the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, with headquarters in Fairbanks. On their website, they say that the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge sustains people, wildlife, and fish in the northeastern corner of Alaska, a vast landscape of rich cultural traditions and thriving ecological diversity. It's located on the traditional homelands of the Inuplot and Gwinnett people. Approximately the size of South Carolina, the refuge has no roads or facilities. The lands and waters are a critical home to migratory and resident wildlife, have unique recreational values, and contain the largest designated wilderness within the National Wildlife Refuge System. Many people may know of the refuge by the abbreviation ANWR or ANWR. The full name reminds us that the refuge is part of our national heritage designated for wildlife.
The Arctic National Refuge Range contains no public facilities, but does contain three wild and scenic rivers and the largest designated wilderness, about 8 million acres, in the National Wildlife Refuge System. The Brooks Range, with peaks and glaciers to 9,000 feet, dominates the refuge. These mountains extend east to west in a band 75 miles wide, rising abruptly from a flat tundra-covered plain. This treeless expanse is cut by numerous braided rivers and streams. South of the Continental Divide, rivers wind serpentine courses through the broad, spruce-covered valleys dotted with lakes and sloughs. The refuge includes an array of landscapes and wildlife habitats, from the boreal forest of the Porcupine River uplands to the foothills and slopes of the Brooks Range, to the Arctic tundra of the coastal plain, to the lagoons and barrier islands of the Beaufort Sea coasts.
The coastal plain is the heart of this Arctic ecosystem, supporting the 197,000 animal porcupine caribou herd, millions of migratory birds, and a full complement of large predators such as wolves, grizzly bears, and polar bears. The ground lies permanently frozen below much of the refuge. This impenetrable permafrost layer causes many areas to remain wet during the summer. Plants grow rapidly with 24-hour daylight, but the growing season is short. These factors make a refuge a fragile area easily impacted by human activities. In the most northern of refuges, plant communities take a long time to recover from disturbances.
The Audubon Society tells some of the history of the refuge. It was first set aside by Dwight David Eisenhower as the Arctic National Wildlife Range in 1960. But in 1980, Congress enlarged the original range to protect additional wildlife habitat and to establish the refuge. In the same move, Congress closed the coastal plain to oil development, and any move to allow oil drilling activity would then require a new act of Congress.
Yet, in 2017, President Trump signed a tax bill into law that included a provision that opened the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil and gas drilling to offset massive corporate tax cuts. And in January of 2021, an oil and gas lease sale was held with the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, emerging as the highest bidder. On January 20th, 2021, the Biden-Harris administration put a temporary halt on oil and gas development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. There are also several lawsuits proceeding through the court system to stop oil and gas development in the refuge, including National Audubon Society versus Bernhardt.
We'll do an update on the Biden administration's stance on drilling, although it's difficult to sort through everything that's going on. But first, we have to discuss what happens to the tundra with human invasion. The ground is so sensitive because of the permafrost, which makes it remarkably fragile. It's not uncommon for footprints that have been placed on the tundra to be in existence decades after they were made, just like Neil Armstrong on the moon.
One group opposing oil drill are the Gitxin people of Alaska and Canada. Here's a tribal elder talking about the historic importance of the land, including reference to the caribou, who will not cross land scarred by drilling.
The land is everything. Money is short term. The land will always be here for us. We, Gitxin people, have the inherent right to continue to live our own way of life. That right depends upon clean air, clean water, a clean environment, our own food security, which is based entirely on the porcupine caribou herd. Current threat, the United States passed a tax cut bill. The line item included provisions to drill the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. That's the last 5% of America's public land in the Arctic that's still protected. That's the last 5%. 95% is already owned and can be drilled for oil in Alaska's North Slope. How do they plan to feed our communities once the caribou do not migrate near our communities anymore? How are they going to restore a culture when it's taken? It's ingrained in my blood to fight for this land and our rights. We're not compromising or negotiating the
Here is a recording of the head of the Gitxin Steering Committee discussing the importance of the tundra lands, both to her as an individual and as a member of the group.
Okay. My name is Bernadette Dementif. I am from Fort Yukon, Alaska. I am the executive director for the Gitxin Steering Committee. Defend the sacred. It means protecting our way of life, who we are as Gitxin people, who we are as indigenous people. It's protecting our identity, our food security, our homelands, because it's all interconnected. The way the world is now, I think that we don't realize how spiritual everything really is. Like, when I went up there, I felt like there was like a ton of bricks on my chest. I don't understand what was wrong, but I just came so overwhelmed and I started crying. And like, I could still close my eyes and I can picture what I see. And it's all the mountains, all the lakes. And I just understood why my ancestors returned every year. And that's when I decided that, you know, I asked for forgiveness from Creator for being disconnected for so long, but that I'm here now to share in my responsibility as a Gitxin. And since that time, I've really been taking this position that I'm in more serious. I really learn along the way, and I really utilize my leaders because they have... Everybody here is so valuable that lives here in Fort Yukon. They don't realize it. All the knowledge that they have is valuable. And so I don't ever make decisions on my own. The Gwich'in Steering Committee belongs to the Gwich'in Nation, and we all stand united to protect the Calvin Grounds. Even when I didn't fully understand what that meant, I still knew in my heart that's what I had to do, is protect this place. And that is our spiritual connection. It is all interconnected. Our identity as Gwich'in has a huge part to do with that caribou herd. We're going to fight till the first oil rig goes in, and we'll fight after. We're never going to stop defending that Calvin Grounds. You know, our ancestors, they told us to go out and tell the world that we're here. Do it in a good way and do not compromise our position. They didn't tell us to see what we could get out of it. They told us to protect it. And that is, that's what my goal is.
So where do things stand? As recently as December 1st, the Biden administration delayed release of a new environmental review for drilling in Alaska's Arctic Refuge. We read from a report from Nathaniel Herz, Alaska Public Radio. It is dated December 1st of this year. The Biden administration has delayed by several months the release of a new environmental review of oil drilling in the Arctic National Refuge. The review, known as the Draft Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement, was originally set for release by the end of November. All oil development work in the refuge is effectively stalled until the new review process concludes. The report's release will now be delayed until the second quarter of next year. That's according to status reports filed late Wednesday by U.S. Department of Justice attorneys, with the federal court handling three separate lawsuits over the refuge leasing program. A spokesman for the U.S. Department of the Interior, which is overseeing the leasing program, declined to comment further.
We continue in that article. The Arctic Refuge drilling program was a contentious piece of the Trump administration's energy agenda. Following Congress's vote to open the area to drilling as part of the 2017 tax reform package, conservation groups, tribes, and anti-drilling U.S. states each filed lawsuits to challenge the administration's oil leasing process and the environmental reviews. Following an auction in the final days of Trump's term, the Biden administration suspended the active leases in the refuge. Then, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland announced the new review process, saying she found multiple legal deficiencies in the leasing program, including insufficient environmental analysis. And by the way, the 2017 tax reform package requires the federal government to hold a second lease sale by 2024. Thus, the question of leasing in the tundra reindeer territory remains in doubt. But in the meantime, this bit of semi-good news from the Washington Post, written by Stephen Mufson and Joshua Partlow, who write,
"It seems that once eager to drill, oil companies have exited leases in the Arctic Refuge. Two Alaska investors remain, but the analysts say they lack the expertise or financial power to develop on their own. Three major oil companies have given up opportunities to explore for oil in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge after the industry and Republican politicians have spent decades working to gain access to the sensitive region. Regenerate Alaska, a division of an Australian firm and the only oil company to directly acquire a tract on the refuge's nearly 1.6 million acre coastal plain, canceled its lease last month after Chevron, Hillcorp, and two other major oil companies had also jettisoned their claims.
This exit makes it far less likely that drilling will take place soon in a vast, unspoiled landscape that has achieved iconic status among environmentalists and has been fought over for half a century. an Anchorage real estate investor and the state-owned Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority still hold leases, but industry analysts say they lack the financial power and expertise to develop the remote area on their own.
While Republicans enacted legislation in 2017 mandating two major lease sales in the refuge by the end of 2024, a coalition of indigenous rights and environmental groups has launched a campaign to pressure corporations against investing in any developments there. The 20 million acre preserve hosts hundreds of thousands of migrating caribou and waterfowl each year and provides critical habitat for the southern Beaufort Sea remaining polar bears. This positive news for the climate and the human rights of indigenous people whose survival depends on a healthy, thriving calving ground for porcupine caribou herd and further proves that the oil industry recognizes drilling on sacred lands is bad business. That's what Carlin Itchok said in a statement from the state director of the Wilderness Societies of the Wilderness Society in Alaska.
The Washington Post article continues, five major banks, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, and Wells Fargo, and a growing list of insurance companies have stopped giving financing for the Arctic oil business. I have to interject here. I can't think this is totally out of environmental concern. They figured out that drilling was more expensive than they thought. Quote, it seems all the oil companies with leases there have concluded that drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is unwise after all, said Eric Groff, deputy managing attorney in Earth Justice's Alaska regional office. Graf, who for years has been involved in litigation to block oil and gas development in the refuge, said, quote, we are glad that these companies may finally have seen the light, concluding that investing in Arctic oil is a bad deal on a planet that urgently needs to shift away from fossil fuels. A year ago, the Biden administration suspended the leases that the department's Bureau of Land Management had awarded 2 weeks before Trump left office, saying the agency did an insufficient analysis. We read about that, and that's why they're reconsidering it.
However, the State Development Agency, which bought seven leases covering 366,000 acres just before Trump left office, is still trying to get permits to do seismic studies and preparatory work for drilling in the refuge. Alan Weitzner, the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority's executive director, said in an interview Thursday he is not surprised that the oil companies decided to leave the refuge in the face of repeated obstacles from the federal government, which creates, quote, a time sink for corporations within that area. In my mind, it's very unfortunate, he said, that major investors in the state of Alaska are not being allowed to continue to pursue development and are being really pushed to look elsewhere, in large part outside of the U.S., he added. There are delays and just outright denials of requests for permitting to ultimately pursue the activities that you need to do.
So the politics and the use of fossil fuels continues. Dan Sullivan of Alaska, a Republican, said the Biden administration actions were to blame for the departure of the companies. Quote, the Biden administration continues to tell American people that they are doing all they can to bring down energy prices, he said. Then they take actions that do the exact opposite, especially in Alaska. Sullivan added that this creates enormous uncertainty, driving away and chilling investment in these resource development projects, including ANWR, which our country desperately needs.
Oh, sigh. There are many obstacles to drilling in the Arctic Refuge. There are no roads or facilities, so building infrastructure to support exploration would be costly. There's long opposition to drilling in the refuge, which has only intensified as climate change worsens, driven by burning of fossil fuels. The Alaskan Arctic has warmed at least three times more than other parts of the country, posing new risks to oil infrastructures on the North Slope as permafrost melts. If you look at the project proposals in other parts of the Arctic, they're using things like chillers to freeze the permafrost so they can drill more. said Jenny Rawlinson Shea, Deputy Director for Public Lands at the Center for American Progress, a liberal think tank. It's not getting any colder in the Arctic. It's only getting harder to do things like drill, and it's a vicious cycle.
So the future regarding Arctic refuge drilling remains in doubt, but we're somewhat encouraged by those recent the pulling out of the oil companies and the fact that Deb Haaland is going to continue the environmental rule review. We hope she reaches the right conclusions. We'll follow up on this story, particularly when the environmental review comes out in 2023. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and Susie the Reindeer might have something more
to say. Well, I just have a quick editorial comment because we're almost out of time. But here you see the typical people who are looking for money, supporting development. It's like what we have in Chico. It's like what Nevada has with their mining of lithium in Nevada. People who want to make money and will destroy the environment in order to do it. And we need to just, we people who care for the nature and for the earth need to stand firm.
Yes, and amen. and we did, the opinions expressed on Ecotopia in many cases represent our opinions, but not necessarily
Absolutely.
Those of anybody else. Coming up at 6 o'clock, it's North State Give and Take with Bobby Tryon, who will be interviewing Sherry Scott, local nursery owner and all-around good green person. And then at 6:30, it's Ginger Nichols doing Radioactives. That's it for Ecotopia tonight. Thank you for listening.
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond.
North State Give and Take is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Butte College, where your future starts with three-week classes beginning January 3rd. And they are offered online at the Butte College main campus or Chico Center. Can't join this winter? Spring classes include cosmetology and barbering at the main campus, Chico, and Skyway Centers, and their new Glenn County Center in Orland. Promise scholarships are also available for first and full-time students.